So the ninth step then is the step that allows me to live in the world. I remember saying to an old timer one time that I didn't think what was the value of the ninth step, and he said, "Well," he said, "what's your philosophy about life?" And I said, "Well, it's basically do unto others and move to another state." And he said, "How would you like to live in a world where you could walk around any corner at any time and not be afraid of who you're going to run into?" And I remember I was overwhelmed by that concept that I'd never have to worry again about who I'd run into because my life was essentially even. I had nothing, you know, I owed no one anything in the way of amends or this or that. And he said that was the great promise. And it has been the great promise. And out of it comes tremendous miracles. I remember I served with a man one time, and he's a very important man to me, because he was one of the first men who taught me to truly believe in myself. He pulled me aside. I was a young corporal, lance corporal when I met him, then I made corporal. And he said to me, he's a lieutenant, and he said to me, "You're one of the most talented and brightest men I've known in a long time." He said, "Why don't you go to officer's candidate school?" And that had been a secret dream of mine, but I didn't think a guy like me could do that. And he said, "You can." And so he taught me how to take tests. He drilled me about standing in front of the board and interviewing and all that stuff. And he really taught me the skills necessary to do these things. And so I got that appointment, and then I had that event I talked about day before yesterday about leading a patrol in a blackout down in Santo Domingo and being shot at and things like that and not remembering any of it. And 2 months later, I was to go to officer's candidate school, and instead I just got out and left. And I did what I always did. I just folded my tent and took off. And I never said anything to this man. He had completed his act at the time by then, and he was on my amends list because he was an example of how I used to deal with life. I'd fold my tent and run and leave people wondering and things like that. And I remember I kept him on my list, and I kept praying to find him. And about 6-7 years ago, I was in my den. I was stretching. I was going to go for a run. And I had just finished my card thing in the morning with my ninth step people, my eighth step cards, and just a few left at that time. And he was one of them. And I was stretching. And I just remembered a conversation we'd had aboard ship in the Mediterranean in 1964. And we were on a fantail watching the stars and things. And he said, "One day I'm going to," he was a Notre Dame graduate, I'd forgotten that, and he said, "One day," he said, "I'm going to live where I can see the Golden Dome." And I picked up the phone and I called South Bend Information and I asked for his name, and he was living across the street from the university. And I called and his wife, Sharon, answered the phone and I said, "You wouldn't remember me." I said, "But my name is Keith Lewis." She said, "Oh, Corporal Lewis." She said, "Brian talks about you all the time." And I said, "Is he around?" And she said, "He's out for a run. He'll be right back. Please don't go anywhere." And so I waited, and he called me back. And I told him why I wanted to make amends, and that is that I had taken the gift he had given me and just disregarded it. And I told him why, and I told him I was a member, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and things like that. And he said, "You know," he said, "I'm so glad that you did that." He said, "Every week I would get a copy of the Navy Times," and he said, "I would hold my breath, and I'd go through the aisles to see if you had been killed in Vietnam." And he said, "I'm so grateful." And we talked, and I said, "Do you have any?" He asked me, "I have family," and I told him about my children. And he said, "I have children too." I said, "How are they doing?" He said, "Well, they're doing really well." And then he stopped, and he said, "You know, just this morning," my son came home. He got drunk and he ended up in jail last night. And just this morning, he came home, and Sharon and I prayed and asked God if he would do something to help our son. And I said, "I know the name of a man who's a member of the same fellowship I am in your town. Can I give you his name and number?" And he said, "I'd really appreciate it." And I never called back. I've never found what's happened or anything else. But I know I made that amends. And I also know why it was 18 or 20 years before I could remember that he had gone to Notre Dame and one day wanted to live in South Bend, Indiana. And those are the kinds of things that happen as a result of the ninth step. And that's why when we, you know, when we focus and concentrate on the ninth step, it says before we're halfway through, if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, We're going to be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experiences can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Oftentimes people will say, you know, as soon as I get over these problems, I'll see what I can do about dealing with the world around me. And I found that if I focus on my problems, that's where I always stay stuck. But if I'll go ahead and get to work on the ninth step and try to repair the damage I've done, that the world becomes a much friendlier place and most of the problems go away. I think that what we refer to as problems are a lot like my inbox. I don't know about you, but I'll let stuff stack up in my inbox for a month. Then I'll go through and I'll find it's too late for most of it anyway, so I just throw it away. And if it's truly important, I'll take care of it. But that's how I eliminate a lot of stuff in the inbox, by just waiting and doing other things and not focusing on it and not making myself crazy with those things. And the ninth step works like that. You know, it's an amazing phenomenon, the steps, the process of getting well. It's one of the most logical things that I've ever seen in my life. And you know, logic is important. I think it's really very, very important. And I don't know if anybody here has taken courses in logic, but I know a story about a man. He's a redneck. Now he wouldn't be from around here, but I got a kick out of how people feel about their locality. Julie and I were down in South Carolina, south of Charleston, a place called Edisto Beach. They have a wonderful little conference down there. We're down there for the conference, and Julia went on a tour, and one of the ladies down there take people on tours of the plantations, and so they're going around, and Julia's always trying to find an opportunity to say something nice to people. It just astounds me. I mean, even people she doesn't like, she says nice things to, which is fine, but I don't like it when she says nice things to people I don't like, anyway, she's on a tour, and this lady was trying so hard to make it all interesting and everything, and Julia said to her, I feel fortunate. Julia was born in North Carolina. She said, I feel fortunate to have been born in the South. She said, there's a great tradition, having been born in the South. And the woman looked at her and said, oh, really? She said, well, I was born in the Deep South versus the South. So Julia said, what flashed through my mind was, oh, are you from Mississippi? But she said, I didn't say it. And I said, why would you think of something like that? And she said, I've been married to you for 10 years. So two rednecks decided they weren't going anywhere in life, though they should go to college to get ahead. The first one goes to see a counselor who tells him to take math, history, and logic. What's logic? So the first redneck asks. The professor answered by saying, let me give you an example. Do you own a weed eater? I sure do. Then I can assume, using logic, that you have a yard, replied the professor. That's real good, says the redneck. The professor continues, logic will also tell me that since you have a yard, you also own a house. Impressed, the redneck said, amazing. And since you own a house, logic dictates that you have a wife. That's Betty May. This is incredible, the redneck said. Finally, since you have a wife, logically, I can assume that you're heterosexual, said the professor. You're absolutely right. Well, that's the most fascinating thing I ever heard. I can't wait to take that logic class. The redneck, proud of his new world opening up to him, walks back into the hallway where his friend is still waiting. So what class is y'all taking? Asks the friend. Math, history, and logic, replies the first redneck. What in tarnation is logic? Asks his friend. Let me give you an example. Do you own a weed eater? Asks the first redneck. No, his friend replied. You're homosexual, aren't you? So logic would dictate that these steps have something that's supposed to happen. There's a methodology to all of this. And it's really fascinating when you look at the first nine steps. You know, the first one finally defines the problem, doesn't it? That I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's become unmanageable. What that means is that my resources have absolutely run out. My friend Bob B. used to say, Maggie's friend, used to say, we did a lot of 12-step calls together. And he'd say, I hope we didn't interrupt that man's last drunk, because he's got to finish his last drunk. And what he meant was there was a little bit of arrogance, and I can do it myself left. And, of course, alcohol beats that out of us. And it was beaten out of me. And I'm convinced that, plus the fact that I met you, is why I hadn't taken a drink since my first meeting. The second step says that if I'm in that kind of condition, then there's got to be power someplace. Lack of power is my dilemma. And the second step tells me that in a progressive nature or fashion, I will begin to find power outside of me. And the first time, the first sense of power I had was a firm handshake and a man looking me in the eye. And then it began to expand. I remember that sense of belonging and feeling okay for a few minutes after the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. And by the time I got home, I would chase it away. But I remembered that at some place there was peace and there was certainty and there was some sense of belonging. And so I would be back at the meeting the first opportunity the next day, and I would re-experience that and re-experience that. And then I found that I could experience that power with a phone call. And then I remember one time I was riding to a meeting with my, and I found the great secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. It may separate us from every other form of recovery. I was on the way to a meeting with my sponsor, and I said to him, I was angry, because I was angry at everything, and I had a line of things to be angry about, and I just said to him, I said, when am I going to stop being a newcomer? And he always gave me these smart aleck answers. He said, when you stop getting angry every time they say newcomer, you know, remember, so I ground. And we went to the meeting, and the following week, we're going to the same meeting, and I said to him, I hope Bill's there. And he said, who's Bill? I said, Bill's the new guy who came last week. I said, every morning when I prayed and asked God to keep me sober and to keep you sober, I asked him to keep Bill sober too. And Dan looked at me and smiled, and he said, you're no longer a newcomer. And I found that the great strength and the growth and the power comes from being concerned about another human being. And it surprised me that I was concerned about another human being. That wasn't my way. You know, when you're selfish and self-centered to the extreme, being concerned about another newcomer isn't my way. I would be concerned if too many people came and there wouldn't be any coffee left for me. You know, something like that, something deeply spiritual. But here I am concerned about the welfare of another human being, and it amazed me. And, of course, as we grow in this program and in the third step, we entertain the fact that there's a power greater than ourselves. And not only that he loves me enough to see me get well, that he has my best interest at heart. I have a good friend, Mike W., who sort of hand-fed me back to a belief in a higher power I grew up with. I said to him, I said, you really believe, I was sober about a year or something, and I said, do you really believe God loves you? And he said, he was going through some difficult times and handling them beautifully. I said, do you really believe God loves you? He said, I do. And I said, how much? And he had a crucifix on his wall, and he pointed to it, and he said, this much. And it overwhelmed me. It shut me up, which was a difficult thing to do. And I didn't want to agree with him, but I was impressed with what he believed. And the second and third step really taught me that what kept me sober in the beginning wasn't the fact that I thought it would work for me, but the fact that you thought it would work for me. And I'd call my sponsor and say, oh, I'd say, he'd say, hello, I'd say, are you sure? He'd say, I'm positive. I'd say, okay, and hang up. That's all it took. If he believed I could do it, I could do it. And then one day I believed I could do it. And I believed because you did. You said things like, you can't miss. If you do what we do, you can't miss. And I began to believe that that was true. And then, of course, the fourth step begins with that house cleaning. And the fourth step is not possible without the third step. The third step is what gives me the courage to look and do the fearless and searching moral inventory. And then, of course, the fifth step is where I share with God, myself, and another human being the exact nature of my wrong. And the sixth step is where I find a great spiritual truth that of myself I'm nothing. I can't change me. All the wanting in the world can't change me. But the seventh step which is so beautifully done in the manuscript, where it says, humbly on our knees, ask God to remove these defects of character, holding back nothing. You know, with some of my defects of character, some of the things that were in my way were so devastating to me, year in and year out, and so deteriorated my spirit that one day on my knees I begged to be changed. And I'd like to take a minute here to talk a little bit about relationships. I know that when I'm in a discussion meeting and somebody says, does anybody have a problem? And somebody puts up their hand, and if it's not mother had a square nipple, then it has to do with relationship. And so I'm frightened when I hear somebody say that, but I just want to give you an example of how these defects of character can be taken away. I always tried to solve my own problem, and one problem that I experienced a lot as an isolated guy was the problem of lack of intimacy and loneliness. I don't mean friends. I had a lot of friends, and I could always get a foursome for a game of golf, and I had buddies and things like that. But what I didn't have was an intimate relationship, and the reason I didn't was because I did it all wrong. You know, I tried to start my interpersonal relationships at the end and work to the beginning. I tried to start off satisfying my sexual drives and then work toward friendship somehow. And I always ended up in relationships that were selfish and self-centered and mutually destructive. And after about 12 or 13 years of so-called, well, I was sober in a lot of ways, and I banged my head against this problem for such a long time, and I was leaving Alabama to go back to North Carolina, and I was up there visiting, and I stayed at my friend's house, at Bob Brown's house. He had a wonderful little house on a fourth tee at this golf course, and it was a little two-bedroom place, so whichever one of his friends, he never locked it. When he bought the house, he threw the keys away, went out on the balcony and threw the keys away, and he said, God gave me this house, I'm not going to lock it. And people, he'd be on vacation, people would go out there and stay there and do their fourth steps and things like that. And he'd come home, there'd be three or four people, the coffee would be going to be three or four people on the deck looking out into the woods, writing and things like that. I got there and I went in the guest room and I was in anguish. I had terminated another one of those relationships where we competed and beat each other up, did all that dumb stuff that self-centered, selfish people do. And I just had it, and I got on my knees, and I told God, I said, I'm gonna pray till I get this resolved. I said, I can't live like this anymore. And humbly on my knees, I begged him to remove this defect of character. And I prayed all night. I prayed all night. And my friend Dick Corcoran, who's since passed away, came in after me, so he had to sleep on the sofa. He missed the bedroom by 5 minutes, but he knew something was going on, and we were close, close friends, and he prayed most of the night, too. And I can tell you it was the night of July the 4th, 1985, because what I concluded the next morning was I told God, I said, I'm never going to abuse my friendship with another female again with your help. I said, with your help, I'll never do anything that I feel guilty about the next day again. And I said, I'm going to live a celibate life. I'm going to take all my energy and focus on helping people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I ever have a companion or a partner, it will be because you pick them and not because I pick them. And the next time, I'm going to let somebody else tell me how to do this because I don't know how to do it. And that night, I went to a meeting Bob Brown was speaking at, a meeting I didn't want to go to, but I went to, and I met the woman I later married. And I fell, in love with her immediately. And I called my sponsor and said, the one thing I know is that I don't know anything about being with another human being. I don't know how to be in a relationship without competing. I don't know how to do these things. Will you help me? And he said, I'll help you if you do everything I tell you to do. I said, it's done. And so I kept him up on everything. And finally I said to him one day, I went to him, I said, Julian, I have decided, after about 2 months, I said, Julian, I have decided to make this an exclusive relationship. He said, no, you can't do that. And I said, but there's nobody else I want, and I love her, and I'm going on and on. And he said, I'm telling you, Keith, don't do that. He said, you have a lot of friends in the program or women. He said, start treating them like friends. And so friends of mine and I would go to dinner, we'd go to a movie, and just be friends. And he said, you're not ready for an exclusive relationship. And he said, one day you'll know why. And I just took him at his word and did what he said. And about 6 months later, I went to him and I said, you know, Tom, what I've always done is if I find that I care for someone, then my first thought is if they could pick anybody or me, they'd pick the other person. And so what I do is I try to tie them into an interpersonal or exclusive relationship before I'm ready for fear that they'll find somebody else and I'll lose. And I said, and then I end up resenting the fact that I feel trapped. And he said, very good, very good. He said, you're now 17 years old. And so then he said, now it's okay. So Julie and I then began our exclusive relationship. And then one day I said to him, I said, you know, we're going to get married. He said, wait a minute. He said, what happened to engagement? I said, that's an old-fashioned idea. He said, well, it got to be that way for a reason, Keith. And he said, I want you to be engaged. And I said, okay. So I bought a ring and I got all ready, and it was Christmas Eve. And I had a fire going in the fireplace, and Julia came over to my place. We were going to go to midnight mass together and then open gifts under the tree at my house. And I was dressed up, and I had asked her parents for permission to marry their daughter. Her mother said, oh, I think that'd be wonderful. And her father said, go for it. I had this all figured out. I had as nervous as I could be, but I had practiced and things like that. And it just fell apart like a cheap suit. I was just about ready to go into my act. And she said, excuse me, I want to powder my nose. And she went in the bathroom. Well, once you get started, you can't stop. So I chased her in the bathroom and I put the ring on the wrong finger, the wrong hand, and asked her if she'd marry me. And she just fell into my arms and just sobbed. And we went off to mass together that night. And whenever we looked at each other, we just cried. And it was just an incredible thing. And I found that being engaged is different than an exclusive relationship. I found myself doing strange things, like getting out my date book and saying, look, I just wanted you to know that I've agreed to do this conference, and I'm going to be going to new work here and everything else. And, you know, if there's anything you have planned, please tell me so I can put it down now before all the weekends fill up. And I began allowing another human being to have a say in my life. And it's, even married, I'd always protected all of that. It's none of your business. You live your life, I have mine, and, you know, all that nonsense. And 50-50, which, of course, is the worst thing that can happen to a marriage, is attempting 50-50. Because whenever I looked at it, it looked awfully lopsided on her side to me, whenever, you know. And she thought it was lopsided the other way. And I want to give 100%, and so does my wife, and that's why I think it works. And then, error number 14, I went to Tom and I said, wonderful thing. I said, God's hand's really in this relationship. He said, I know it is. And I said, I tell you what happened just yesterday. I said, Julia has an opportunity to transfer her job over to my town now, you know. And I said, so we're going to live together until it's time to get married. He said, no, no, no. And I said, well, why not? And he said, look. He said, you've done it all right. He said, why do you want to enter into a way of living which violates your principles now? He said, that's number one. He said, number two, he said, you're a long-term member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, people watch you, and they watch what you do. They watch how you carry yourself. They watch how you conduct yourself. He said, you've even stopped cursing on a golf course because people know you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, why would you want to do something like this and jeopardize everything at this late date? And, of course, he was right, and I went back and told Julia that, And you know how it works. You know, we were married 4 or 5 months later, and I carried her across the threshold, my wife. It was an incredible experience. And 3 days later, she was able to transfer her job to my town. And what I'm saying is that the seventh step made me realize that I didn't know anything about how to do it myself. And I desperately needed God in this thing. And we get to the tenth step, the tenth step is that marvelous step that says, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And the big book says, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into our activities. How best can I serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These thoughts must go with us constantly. Now, the reason these thoughts can go with us constantly is because I'm no longer trying to run the show to suit myself. You know, I'm no longer focusing on what's wrong and what I want and all the rest of it. My focus now is outward. Remember what Father Powell told me. He said, first you discover who you are, then you fully accept who you are, and then you forget who you are. And self-forgetting is a key to peace and serenity, because the view is always outside. When I was newly sober, my sponsor made me go talk to one of the old guys who brought Alcoholics Anonymous to Washington, D.C., and he was on his deathbed, and he made me go talk to him. I didn't want to go talk to some old guy, and I didn't want to go to talk to some old guy who was dead. I mean, he's going to die pretty soon. What good was he to me? You know, he couldn't help me get a job or anything like that. And, but I did it because my sponsor made me do it. And I went over and I sat down and I talked to this man, and I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed talking to him. And it wasn't until later, you know how you go back and you think about what happened? It occurred to me that out of 3 hours, we spent 2 hours and 50 minutes talking about me and 10 minutes talking about him. He was so excited that this kid had found Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 29 years of age. He was so excited that I had a sponsor and that I had a home group. And I mean, it was the biggest thing of him to him that day. And it was a man who was near death. And I thought, if I'd have been the one near death, I would have wanted to be doing all the talking and all the whining, and I would have wanted it to be about me. But it wasn't. It was about others, because here was a man who had truly forgotten himself, who truly found the key to the spiritual existence. And what was happening to him was just fine, and it wasn't important. What was happening to me was important. And I discovered something about people who work the steps and live this program. He had forgotten who he was. Comes the acid test. Can we stay sober and keep emotional balance and live to good purpose under all conditions? You know, there have been a lot of attempts at helping alcoholics, and some of them have been like therapeutic communities where you go live together and you call each other names and beat each other up and do all that stuff and scare each other and you cannot drink together. But what good is that? Because you can't leave there. You can't leave there without being filled with fear and trepidation and anger at the world and all the rest of it. Alcoholics Anonymous is just the opposite. When I went to that little treatment center, they asked me, what is it that you want? And I said, I just want to go to a, I want to be put someplace where I won't hurt myself or anybody I love anymore. And they said, you can't do that. If you're going to be well, you can't hide out. You can't hide out in a treatment center. You can't even hide out in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're going to be well, you have to live in the world, and you have to live in the world to good purpose. How does that happen? It happens through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a lot like, breaking a bone, you know, it's a very, very traumatic and difficult thing. But when the bone heals, it's stronger there than at any other point. And I think that's what happens in these 12 steps. It becomes strong. And it's in the 10th step where we observe and watch what happens. It's in the 10th step where we make judgments about not ourselves, because our will and our life is no longer any of our business, God's business. We made that decision back in the 3rd step. It's in the 10th step where on a day-to-day basis I see how I live my life and whether or not I do his will. Even whether I'm using the character defects I found in the 7th step to his benefit, to his good. And this is also where I see people overcome exception and extreme difficulties in their lives. you know, it happened to me. I think there are times in our sobriety that, or times when we move to the next level, if we're prepared. One of the things that that happened to me, I was sober about 6 years, and a little over 6 years, and I was one of those unfortunate people who got everything he said he'd need to be happy. I had the house with the hardwood floors, and I was a skinny young fellow. I was running marathons. I had a very, very active social life, and I knew that's what I always wanted, And, you know, and I had season tickets to the symphony and to Folgers Theater and on. I had all these things that I knew you need to be happy. And I had come to realize just how miserable I was. And I was into self-aggrandizement. I had to be noticed. On and on. My ego was just totally out of control. And I had a job I loved very much, and I had a bunch of people who worked for me. And I always worried about something might happen to these people. So I set up a system within our organization that if anybody began to get into trouble, we could all sit down and tell that person that. And most of us were recovering people, so that was the agreement. If you work here, you have to be willing to have someone tell you what they see if they see something that concerns them. And I was just being wonderful and brilliant and miserable. I was waking up in the middle of the night. I just had all sorts of problems. I was running, you know, I just run further and faster and lose more weight, and I was just nuts, just complete out of my mind. And one day I walked into work, and all those ingrates who worked for me were sitting in a room with yellow pads, number 2 pencils. They asked me if I'd sit down and listen to some of their concerns. And they began to talk about some of the things I've been doing and how I couldn't be wrong. And I treated them all like they were stupid and they didn't know anything. I was the only person who knew anything, and on. And it got around to a dear friend of mine who was a my administrative assistant, and she I knew loved me. I mean, I knew they all cared about me, but I knew that this woman loved me. We were dear and close friends. And she began to cry, and she said something that terrified me. She said, you know, Keith, she said, every lunchtime you go to an AA meeting, which I did, it was down, right down the street. And she said, you used to come back all excited and tell me something you had heard. And she said, for the last month you've been coming back telling me something you said. And I knew that was wrong. And so I called my sponsor, who agreed that I had not been on my game of late. And I won't go into details, but I had begun to violate values and spiritual principles and stuff that I never could have imagined I would do. And if I wasn't doing it, I wanted to. And my life was completely out of control. I was seriously depressed. And you'd have to ask this question, you know, time when can we stay sober and in emotional balance and to good, living lives to good purpose under all conditions. And I had clearly lost it. And I went to a friend of mine who was a psychiatrist, and he's a dear friend. And he sat down and I told him, honestly, what had been going on with me, and he said, I'm really worried about you, and I said, what do I do? And he said, I want you to go to this place down in Texas. He said, it's a hospital. And he said, I don't know what's wrong with you, but whatever else you need, you need to be loved. And so I agreed with my sponsor, I'd do whatever I was told to do, and so I didn't want to, but I got on the plane, and I'm sober six and a half years, and I know my life's over. I know that professionally, I'm ruined. Nobody's going to ask me to speak at an AA conference anymore. I just know my life's over, you know, and I'm trying to figure out which state I'll move to start all over. And I got down there, and I ran into a guy named David A., and David A. just put his arm around me. David Aronofsky's dead now. And down in Texas, you give your sobriety date, and when I introduced myself, I gave my sobriety date, but I couldn't remember the year that I got sober. And I just started to cry, and he came over and put his arm around me, and he said, all that matters is that you don't drink, and you're going to be okay. And that's the shape I was in. I was just an absolute emotional wreck. It was sort of funny on the way down there. Anybody remember Braniff Airlines? You know, Braniff Airlines had these airplanes, and they painted them all these wild colors, you know. So my life's over, and I'm on a pink jet. Flying to Dallas, Texas, and I get off there, and a man met me, and he took me to this hospital. It was about 11 o'clock at night when I got in there, and so the next morning, my roommate assumed, it was a treatment center, and my roommate assumed that I was a new drunk that just came in the night before, and I was so depressed I couldn't get out of bed, and he came over, he said, hey, buddy, he said, you better get out of bed, he said, that nurse is here, it's a real pain in the neck, and she said, she'll come in here, and she'll be carrying on, you better get out of that bed, and I said, I can't, he said, I'll help you, partner. So he's a big Texan, so he helps me out of bed, and he's putting my shirt on, and we get one arm in the shirt. And he said, I know how you feel. He said, I felt like this. He said, I came in here 6 days ago. He said, I feel a lot better now. He said, how long are you sober? I said, 6.5 years. He said, oh, shit, you know. And he went over and got in bed, and I laid back down. And it was horrendous. And I went back, and I did the first 5 steps again, and I did them as thoroughly as I could. I did 6 and 7, and I gave God my professional life, and I gave him all my belongings. And I began then a practice which I've carried now for over 20 years. And frequently I'll sit down and I'll give God back all the things he's given me and tell him that I only want what he wants me to use today. But then I had to look at the 8th and 9th step, and my arrogance and my self-centeredness and my pride had damaged a lot of people, and I ended up writing letters of amends to everybody who worked for me and told them this is just the beginning. And I wanted to leave my profession. I wanted to leave the state. You know, I was toying with the idea of leaving the country. I mean, I was just mortified, and I knew I couldn't do that. And my sponsor said, come back for 90 days and then do whatever you want to do. And so I went back for 90 days, and of course I was loved and accepted, and I'm still doing what I was doing. But I like to tell that story because it's imperative that we understand that life happens to us. And character defects get in the way. And if we're around people who love us and care about us, they say those things. I'm a bit of a strong personality, I've been told by a few people. My ex-wife and her lawyer, for one. But seriously, so what I do is I make it a practice to find a few strong people around me And I say to him, if you ever see me doing anything out of line, if you ever see me doing anything that violates the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous or good sober living, please tell me. You know, you have carte blanche in my life. Not just my sponsor, my friends, the people who watch me day to day. And I remember I did this, and one of them, I always try to make one of them a woman, because women see things in me that men don't see. And one woman, her name was Nancy, tougher than nails, Nurse Nancy, we called her. And so I, you know, one day I bump into this little honey who moved into town, and she was sober long enough, and she was sicker than hell, but she was sober long enough, and right away the old Keith comes out, and Nancy's watching all this stuff, and after the meeting she said, I want to talk to you. I said, I don't want to talk to you. And she said, I've got permission to say anything I want to. I said, I withdraw the permission. She said, you told me it was for life and it couldn't be withdrawn. I said, leave me alone, sir. So the next day I get a telegram. Dear Keith, stop. You're being a jerk. Stop. Love, Nancy. And I caught her up and she said, what on earth are you doing? I said, I know. It's wrong. I won't, honestly. And I didn't. And I always surround myself with people like that. And I ask a few specifically to have that freedom in my life. And of course, the other thing I do is I tell everything to my sponsor. I tell everything to my sponsor. We call getting current. And we get off and have lunch or play some golf or do something. But we sit down together and get current. And I tell them what's going on. And more importantly, I tell them what I think my motives are for why I'm doing what I'm doing. You know, it's not sufficient. The 10th step tells me it's not sufficient to do what's right. The road's narrowing. I must do what's right for the right reason. And that's the critical aspect of this thing. And that's the value of my sponsor. And that's why having a sponsor who's living the life the way you want to live your life is critically important. I want to be like my sponsor. I'd give anything to be like my sponsor. He's everything that I want to be as a sober man. And so I want him helping me determine. And I've been in and out of a lot of little scrapes and things like that. And he's always there and giving me sage advice or suggestions. And then he always sees that I take definitive action. And he always gives good sage, but we stay current. And the other thing I do when I get with him and get current is I discuss every guy I'm sponsoring and what I'm doing and do you see anything or any input or any this or any of that, you know. And he gives me invaluable advice on how to sponsor and what to do. I consider being a sponsor an extremely, responsible position. I'm not responsible for the person drinking or this or that. I don't mean that. But I'm responsible that I be available to the best of my ability, that I be present when they're talking, that I say the things that are difficult to say when they need to be said, and I need to know what my motives are. Some people, I know some guys who must have been kicked around and beat up at the schoolyard when they were kids because, boy, when a sick human being comes to them and asks them to help them, they feel that it's their turn now and they beat this person up. I'm very, very careful not to do that. Do you have something? Well, I just see it as a responsibility. You know, I'm available to them and I try to be present to them when we're together. I don't lay down rules like, you call me, I'll never call you. Well, that's the dumbest thing in the world. What if God says, you better call me, and I say, I can't. I got some pride, you know. I mean, you got to have standards, God, so I'm not going to call him. That's crazy, isn't it? I mean, if it crosses my mind, I'm in a shower or something like that and say, you better call so-and-so. I pick up the phone and I call him. I mean, otherwise the 11 steps wrong when it says an intuitive thought or a notion. Now it's wrong. I mean, it's a relationship. I'm not an easy guy to get to know. I mean, one of the things I know is that the guys who I sponsor tell other people things before they tell me. And it takes a long, long time for people, I think they see me as severe or something. I mean, that's all I can figure is they see me as severe. Because they're really hesitant about telling me things, you know. And I recognize that, you know. So what I try to do is I try very hard to make it easier for them to do that. Mike and I, it's really funny, the guys that Mike sponsors, Mike and I we're prayer partners. We decided almost 26 years ago that every day we're going to pray for each other. And then we have prayer lists and we exchange them. So every day he prays for the guys I sponsor, I pray for the guys he sponsors, things like that. And, And often, the people will call Mike up and tell him something because they don't want to tell me. You know, and Mike will always say, well, that's very interesting. You know, you probably ought to get around to tell Keith something. I'm not telling him. Well, okay, I won't tell him, but you really might want to get around to tell him. Of course, in a few weeks, they're telling me. Well, you know, a couple of days ago, a guy who Mike sponsors sat down and said, I got to tell you something. I don't want to tell Mike. And so, you know, it goes back and forth. The other thing that I make sure they understand is that my sponsors are available to them. And, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, I had a phone conversation with Tom and his sponsor and his sponsor. And they told me, we've decided that in June you're going to come to Saskatchewan, Canada. You know, and I'm, well, okay, I'll be there. But it's really fun. I mean, it's nice. One time we got together, there were 8 generations of us. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, Cecil's sponsor has 49 or 50 years, something like that. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was with a kid I'd been sponsoring who had 3 weeks. And he couldn't believe it, you know. And he said to me, he said, everybody in AA is old. I said, yeah, we are. I said, old's a great goal for a guy your age in Alcoholics Anonymous, yeah. So the 11th step in sponsorship, or the 10th step in sponsorship and all that. And what I really want to get across with this is that many of us also like the experience of an occasional retreat from the outside world where we can quiet down for an undisturbed day or so of self-overhauling and meditation. Part of what I like to do as part of my 10th step, and I've already talked to a couple of folks about this, is silent retreats. Silent retreats. Now, retreats like this are certainly fine, but silent retreats are also very nice. And I like to go off and do the things that I do for spiritual sustenance, but most of all, just be quiet and be with God. And I find that I stop preparing myself, as I was saying before, to meet the world when I'm in a silent retreat. It's amazing when normally, if somebody's walking toward me on a sidewalk, I prepare myself in case they say something. You know, well, when you go to a silent retreat, you realize you don't need to do that because nobody's going to be saying anything and neither are you. And so you really then get peaceful and quiet inside. And I think that's very, very important. Again, people have been doing that for thousands of years and there's a reason. You know, it's because it works. I remember one time I was very pleased and I went to Sandy, he's my sponsor, and I went to him and said, you know, Sandy, I said something wrong, I insulted somebody, and I immediately stopped and I apologized. And I offered to make amends, and I'm really proud of myself. And because in the old days, I'd have sat around for 3 weeks coming up with good reasons for why I was right to do it. And so this time I just stopped, I said, I'm wrong, and I apologized. And he said, I'm really proud of you. He said, that's the second best way to have done that. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, the best way is to not do it in the first place. And I remember, what a concept. You know, what a concept. You know, pass up the opportunity to hurt someone's feelings, even if you get a laugh out of it. And I think that that's what the 10th step, one of the things the 10th steps help me do, is you recognize that there are other people in the world. Now, it sounds silly, but there are really other people in the world. And not only are they in the world, they are not there for my enjoyment. They aren't there for me to ridicule and kid. You know, they aren't there for me to use. They aren't there for me to entertain. You know, they're there because God has a purpose for them. And so what the 10th step has helped me to understand is that I'm a traveler among travelers. I'm a fellow among fellows. You know, I'm on a journey and you're on a journey. And your journey is every bit as important as my journey. And that I'm just one of many. I remember Sandy said one time when he was first my sponsor, he told me, if you really want to know happiness, seek to be ordinary. And I said, oh, no, you seek to be extraordinary. Everybody's ordinary. You seek to be extraordinary. And he said, no, you seek to be ordinary. And of course that's true. My reading this morning in a Kempis, points that out as well as anything, that the goal was to seek to be ordinary, to see how far I fall short of the mark. And if I'm not falling short of the mark, then my sights are set too low. And these are some of the things that the 10th step tells me. Once this healthy practice, this practice of looking at ourselves, taking personal inventory, once this healthy practice has become grooved, it will be interesting and profitable. that the time it takes won't be missed. One of the things that I do, and this is just the way I do it, I took a look at, on a daily basis at night, I take a look at when I'm disturbed. You know, in the big book, in the 11th step, page 86, it tells me to look out for certain things. And what they really are, they're symptoms to a spiritual illness. It's pride and fear and things like that. And what I like to look at also at the end of the day is conflict. Was there any conflict in my life? Was I disturbed about something? And you know, in the 10th step axiom, of course, it says it is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. If someone hurts us and we are sore, are we in the wrong also? But are there no exceptions to this rule? What about justifiable anger? If someone cheats us, aren't we entitled to be mad? Can't we be properly angry and self-righteous? You know, I had an experience with this a few years ago. A company cheated me out of a substantial amount of money. And I had my case all put together, and I sponsored lawyers. I always try to sponsor at least one lawyer at all times. Let me diverge here for a minute. I worked for a man one time, and he was a lawyer. And we were having a board meeting, and the only seat left was next to him, so I went in and sat down next to him, and he said, "Well, I'm glad you're sitting beside me, Keith." He said, "I always have my lawyer on the other side of me." He said, "Do you know why that is?" I said, "Because you don't trust him behind you?" Yeah. And he didn't think it was funny. But I had my case all made out, and I had a contract, and we're going to sue, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. So I went and talked to Tom about it, and Tom said, "Well, that's one course of action." He said, "Why don't you pray for some alternatives, and or maybe even a different way to look at it. But that's certainly one course of action, and that may be the course you want to take." And I prayed about it, and I thought about it and everything, and I think about it, I get angry and that sort of thing. And here I am doing what I want to do, and I'm living with this. And then I stopped, and I really thought about it. And I said, "Let me look at it differently." So I got out my little yellow pad and my number two pencil, and I began to write about it. And what I realized that for a few years, this company had allowed me to do things a lot of companies never would do. They never, except for one time, ever gave me any grief about leaving early Friday to go to a conference, to speak at a conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to say of my schedule, if I wanted to go to the hospital on a 12-step call, I put everything on hold and I went. And so for 3 years, they allowed me to do an awful lot of stuff that perhaps would not have been permitted someplace else. Now, the truth is I wouldn't have worked someplace else that wouldn't permit that. But I mean, that's just the reality of the thing. And I stopped and thought about it, and I said, "You know, we're even. We're even." I went back and told Tom, I said, "You know, I've prayed about this and thought about this, and this is what they've done. And as far as I'm concerned, we're even." And I said, "Let it be on them, not on me." And he said, "That's fine, but you have to write them a letter and tell them that." He said, "Otherwise, the temptation will always be there to pull out the old paperwork." And he said, "Maybe you'll be sponsoring a new lawyer who doesn't have anything to do." And that's the way alternative thoughts go. There was a time when there was an either and or. I remember when my estranged wife served me again with papers to go to court. And I called up Sandy, and I said, "I got to talk to you." So Sandy was driving from Washington to Baltimore, and served this time about maybe not long at all. No, we were divorced by this time, and served me paper. I guess I was sober about 4 years, and I immediately had a plan. I've always had a plan, and I haven't always verbalized, but it's right there. And the minute something happens, a plan comes out. And it's a good plan. So I had a plan, and I said, she's taking me back to court, and I said, I can't live like this anymore. And I was terrified of court, and court had not been my friend. So he said, "Well," he said, "I understand that." He said, "What's your plan?" I said, "Well," I said, "I'm going to sell everything I have, and we'll buy a camper." And I said, "A pop-up camper." And I said, "I'm going to drive around the country, and I'm going to go to AA meetings and things." I said, "Now I'm going to take..." What are you laughing at? This is a good plan. I'm offended. I said, now I'm gonna put the money in the bank and I'm gonna pay child support. It's gonna be paid, you know, drafted every month into my wife's account, or ex-wife's account. I said, I'm gonna pay child support. I wanna do anything wrong here. And he said, well, he said, that's a good plan. He said, I see a few flaws. Can I point them out? I said, of course, you know. And he said, you know, it gets awfully cold in the winter in North Dakota. I said, well, I'm not going to North Dakota, Sandy. I said, I was going to go to San Diego. He said, no. He said, the first place I look for ex-husbands who buy campers is San Diego. He said, that's the first place I look. And he said, and if you're not there, they'll look in the Keys, because he knew I liked the Keys, you know. And of course, I started laughing. He said, can you think of an alternative to that plan? And this is the truth. Now, I'm sober 4 years. And I said, you know, the only other thing I can think of is to kill her. I mean, I was a man of extremes, run away or kill, you know. And I said, but they'd suspect me right away. He said, oh, yeah, you'd be one of the first people they'd want to talk to, you know. So he said, could I make a suggestion? And I said, sure, what? And he said, why don't you call her up and ask her what she wants? And I said, that's amazing. But then I said, the thought that flashed my mind, I knew better than to say it, was, then that would mean she wins. Wow. Yeah, I was really over all that, wasn't I? I forgive, but I never forget. You know? And so I said, I'll do that. So that evening I called her up, and I said, I got your papers. Okay. I said, what is it that you need? And she said, you know, this is happening to kids, and I have an opportunity to get them into this school, and, you know, I think it'll really be good for them. And I said, well, I think that's a wonderful idea. I said, I'd be glad to do that. She said, you will? I said, yeah. I said, look, I just sent the check offer this month. I said, I'll send the additional money. She said, well, I don't need it till next month. I said, no, let me send it. I said, let me send it. I said, you know, use it for something else. And so I did, and it was so easy. And she said, I'm so glad. She said, I hate that court business. I said, you hate it. I'm the one who always loses. I didn't say it. I just thought it. And then she said, I can't thank you enough. I said, well, it's my pleasure. And I went back to Sandy, and I said, wow, it worked so well. So it was so easy. And, you know, about a month later, I got a raise. Now, you know how AA works. It was almost to the dollar, the amount of increase that I was asked for. And I told Sandy, I said, it's a miracle. And Sandy said, I'm awful glad that you aren't out in that camper someplace. He said, we have a hard time getting a hold of you, telling you everything was all right, you know. So of course, for the next 10 years, the question I always hear, you getting that camper out again, you know. So. But that's a 10th step. And the thing that's important about all of this is connection. None of this could happen, or it couldn't happen simply and with little effort, unless I were closely connected to Alcoholics Anonymous, to a home group, to the God of my understanding, to a sponsor. If I weren't sponsoring people, I wouldn't learn or know half of what I know. You know, the only information that's of value to me is the information I'm sharing. And that's what being a sponsor is all about. It's about sharing. And what it does is it confirms what I know to be true. You know, I'm sitting talking to a guy in prison, and I'm telling him some things. And I'm driving back home. I got a couple-hour drive back from where Danny is. I'm driving back home, and I say, you know, that's true. You know what I told him? I mean, that is really true. Now, I've known it's true for 20 years, but I really know it's true. I mean, really. And that's what sponsoring people do. And if you're not sponsoring somebody, for goodness sake, find someone. Find someone who's brand new. They don't know the difference. Appoint yourself. They don't know. You know, and by the time... You know, by the time, you know, I always tell me, I'm your sponsor, and, you know, if you get rid of me, you need a lawyer, you know, something like that. But you know, find someone. I always need someone who's pretty new. I mean, my buddy, young man I sponsored sober for 7 or 8 months, called me at 2 o'clock to check something out I had said to him the night of, you know, Thursday night at 1:30 or something like that. I said, Brian, what time is it? He said, it's 1:30. Is it too late? I said, no, it's right about on time, Brian, right about on time. He had a question. And, you know, I hung up the phone and I said a prayer for him. And I thought, you know, 27 years ago, I'd have been awake now drinking. Isn't it great? I went back to sleep and slept another 2 hours and got up and caught a plane and came to see you. I haven't been tired. I have all the energy I need. Do You give me that. But that's the 10th step. And the 10th step is our way of living life to its fullest. It's the 10th step is where the enjoyment and the fun and the pleasure and everything is. You know, the 10th step is how I can become a better husband and father and sponsor and human being a day at a time. I can be more satisfied and happier with who I am. It's through the practice of the 10th step. Now, the 10th step is that step that I live my life by. It's a magnificent way to live a life. And it means it can go on and on and on and on and on until I go join Hillary and Bill and Bob and all the people in a big meeting in the sky. It's endless. And of course, as these things go, the result is a closeness to God. And you get closer and closer to God as we understand Him. And I always thought I wanted to be that sobriety would bring me happiness. And you know, sometimes I've been happy and sometimes I haven't been happy. But what sobriety brings me is joy. And joy is based in hope. It's hope of the future. It's hope that a guy like me can be useful to another human being. You know, a guy who hurt and broke everything he touched can be useful in the life of another human being. And this whole business of self-image and all that business, I worry about self-image and things like that. People concerned about. Somebody said to me, how do you know you're okay? Well, I know I'm okay because I see myself in the eyes of a new man. That's how I know I'm okay. That's the reflection. That's the mirror. Some new guy who's terrified and has that fear in his eyes. You remember the fear? It's palatable. You can feel it and taste it when you're with someone who's filled with fear. And you watch that fear go away. You watch that light come on. And I'm okay. That's what a decent self-image is. It's someone who realizes he's doing the best he can with what he's got today. And he's not doing it for anything other than the fact that that's what his father would have him do. He's been given a great gift. And a gift is only good if it's passed on. That's what it's for. The 10th step is my real connection with life. And I'm connected to it on a daily basis. The 11th step. You know, the 11th step is exciting. You know, the 10th step is sort of the drudgery work. But there's a promise with the 10th step, okay? It's on page 93 in the 12 steps and 12 traditions. Whenever we fail any of these people, we promptly admit it to ourselves always and to them also. Then when the admission would be helpful. And these are the keynotes, okay? Courtesy, kindness, justice, and love are the keynotes by which we may come into a harmony with practically anyone. To live in a life, to live in a world that's not filled with conflict is a great gift for me. My family always lived in conflict. Somebody said to me one time, why is it that you and your brother get together, you always win golf tournaments or almost win or something like that? Well, we play euchre as kids. I mean, and my family competes in everything. And competition is very comforting to me. I love it. I love everything about it. But the problem with being a competitive person is that you forget other people are in the world too. And then not everybody needs to be competed with. Some people need to be nurtured and some people need to be cared about and some people need to be affirmed or patted on the head or any number of things. They don't need to be competed with. And I had to learn that life is a lot more than competition. You know, I think it was Yogi Berra said, you show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser. Or Leo DeRocher or somebody. And that's funny, but I'm not sure that it's true. The problem with competition is at least the big shotism, which is something that, that is very, very dangerous for me. And on the last page of the step 10 in the 12 and 12, it talks about, learning daily to spot, admit, and correct these flaws is the essential character builder and good living. Good liver, yeah. It'll lead to a good liver, trust me. And what happens is an honest regret for harms done, a genuine gratitude for blessings received, and a willingness to try for better things tomorrow will be the permanent assets we seek. Having so considered our day, not omitting to take due note of things well done, and having searched our hearts with neither fear nor favor, we can truly thank God for the blessings we have received and sleep in good conscience. Why don't we take about the 11 steps, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. One of the practices that are part of the 11th step and, of course, part of the 10th step that I like to take part in, and I began doing this when I had my awakening at 6 years. One of the things that happened to me down in that hospital as my life was over, and to a real degree it was over, a friend of mine, when I got on the plane, a man who had heard my fifth step, Ed, and I never forget him for this, he handed me a copy of the Big, Big Book when I got on the plane. And I had one, of course, but he handed me one to take with me. And he said, the answer is probably in here. And the other thing he said to me was, I think you're one of those guys who needs a higher power with a first name. And I don't know what he's talking about, but I got down and in utter desperation, laying in bed, and truly my life was over. I mean, I couldn't even call my children and tell them where I was. I didn't know what to tell them. And I grabbed that book and just in rage and said, let's see what the hell you have to say. And I opened it to John chapter 13, and it said, do not let your hearts be troubled. Have faith in God, have faith also in me. He went on to say that it's something that I never understood before. It said that there was a place for me. And I never really believed that there was a place for me. And I was reminded of when I was in that treatment center in the beginning of this journey, that we were all supposed to come up with a question we had always been asking. I said, most of us have been asking questions all our lives. What's a question you've been asking? And it was easy. It didn't take more than a minute or two. The question was this. If I sat here and did nothing, would I be worth loving? Because I always thought I had to earn everything. And everybody said, yo, the answer is yes. Of course, I knew they were saying that because that's what nice people say. And then I discovered that moment that in fact, that's true, that there is a place for me. And I belong there. And it doesn't make me important or unimportant. It just makes me be. And I got on my knees and truly turned my will and life over to the care of God and said, I will make knowing you and service primary tasks of my life. And so I try to know God. And one of the ways I